You're listening to the Bird Dog Babe podcast with my mom, Courtney Bastian.
This episode is presented to you by Purina Pro Plan and Boss Shot Shells.
When it comes to sporting dogs, I think, you know, especially if you're in an urban setting and, you know, maybe you don't hunt, it's you're seeing those hardwired behaviors somewhere, whether it's, you know, Fido chasing the cat around the house or pointing every bird on your walk or just that relentless chase when you're in the dog park and you just can't call them back because that squirrel means so much to them. It's those reasons that people should consider sporting. It's not your dog being bad. It's your dog doing what it's supposed to do. It's just not in a facilitated way. So sporting with your dog is just going to be able to let your dog engage in natural behaviors and let you work with your dog, continue bonding with your dog. It's definitely worth it for whoever you are.
Hey, Bird Dog Babes. My name is Courtney Bastian, and I am obsessed with all things bird dogs. And I'm here to share with you the stories, experiences, knowledge, and opinions from the women and a few guys in the industry that are killing it. I'm a Wisconsin girl living in a Montana world, mom and two incredible kiddos, wife and occasional assistant to a pro gun dog trainer, traveling the U.S. talking about canine nutrition while hunting, raising, and competing with my German wire hair pointers and Brocchi Italiano. As someone who started hunting later in life because I wanted to give my dogs the opportunity to do what they were bred to do, I'm here to help inspire, educate, and connect women to get their bird dogs out in the field and experience a bond like no other. So pour yourself a glass of wine and get ready to be challenged and encouraged while you learn. This is the Bird Dog Babe Podcast. Today, Melinda Benbow, the owner and operator of Urban Uplander Pet Care in Indianapolis, joins us to discuss training bird dogs in the city and how the force-free training approach has worked for her. Melinda also shares her experience as a novice running her English setter, Shug, in her first AKC hunt test. This story is a must-listen, whether you're a novice or experienced trainer or handler. I also strongly urge judges and potential judges of these dog events to have a listen to this one, because as the stewards of the sporting events, it's important to understand how the feedback you give, especially to a novice, can affect them. For many of us, it's these testing venues that are the bridge to turning us into hunters. So let's all do what we can to make these training and testing events a welcoming, positive experience. All right, let's get after it. This episode is presented to you by Purina Pro Plan. What makes a great bird dog is genetics, training, and nutrition, and that's why I trust and feed Purina Pro Plan. With over 500 nutritionists, veterinarians, and scientists on staff, ProPlan delivers a full spectrum of performance and specialized dog food formulas to help bird dogs like yours excel at every stage of life. Purina supports us, the breeders, owners and trainers, the events we compete in, our national breed clubs, canine health research, and our committed partners to conservation groups such as Pheasants Forever, Rough Grouse Society, and Ducks Unlimited. 95 out of the top 100 dogs are fueled by the advanced nutrition of Purina ProPlan. This episode is also presented by Boss Shot Shells. Copper-plated bismuth Boss provides a better, more effective non-lead option than steel and are safe to use in Grandpa's gun. Available in 10, 12, 16, 20, 28-gauge, and 410, direct-to-consumer pricing and cases ship right to your door. Shoot Boss, pattern your shotgun to make more clean and ethical shots, reduce crippling, and remove lead from the uplands, wetlands, and all lands. Find out more at BossShotShells.com. A big shout out to the people and the partners that are helping me to keep the MP3s rolling for this podcast, my Patreon patrons, the bread and butter, the peeps, the community of like-minded individuals that are eager to learn and offer to contribute. Join us for $5 per month on Patreon.com/TheBirdDogBabe. For exclusive discounts, content, and live Q&A sessions, 5% of your contribution goes to the AKC Canine Health Foundation, and another 5% goes to conservation. Dakota 283, unparalleled protection for your dog's travel to and from your next adventure. My favorite is the G3 kennel, which has a recessed handle on top that makes it easy for me to lift in and out of my truck. The keyed panel latching door makes me feel at ease on trips when I have to leave dogs in my truck when I stop for fuel. An added bonus is the drain hole in the back, which makes cleaning a breeze when my dog has been run hard and put away wet. Go to Dakota283.com and use promo code BIRDDOGBABE for 10% off. And by Siren, shotguns for women. Siren carries the only full line of women's shotguns. They are dedicated to providing the equipment and knowledge that make shooting and hunting more enjoyable and less stressful. Newer season hunter, Siren offers multiple options that fit right out of the box. No more compromises. Go to SirenUSA.com and check out all the options available for upland, waterfowl, sporting, and trap shotguns. And while you're there, say hello to Julia, Siren's new 12-gauge sporting that is one of the most stunning shotguns I've laid my eyes on.
All right. Welcome to the podcast, Melinda. How you doing?
I'm good. Thanks so much for having me.
Yes. Thank you for coming on. You've had a busy last couple weeks, and I'm excited to hear all about it.
Yes. Finally having a break.
So tell us a little bit about yourself. So where do you live? What are you doing? All the things.
Yeah. So I live in Indianapolis, Indiana. I am the owner and operator of Urban Uplander Pet Care here. We are a pet care company that does a multitude of different things. We do midday dog walks for families. We provide daycare and boarding. We also offer different training on top of those things. And yeah, we just love doing everything with pets.
Awesome. Are you taking dogs in like overnight for training, or are you doing it morning pickups and drop-offs? How does that look?
So we do a bit of both. We do the daily pickups. So we offer daycare for some clients. Most of our clients start with us as puppies. So that's where the Lodge and Learn does start. We have them come stay with us. Typically, their parents are already headed out on vacation for a couple weeks. So it gives us a perfect amount of time to go ahead and work with the dog. But we do also provide the daily pickups and drop-offs for training as well. I think that's probably my favorite one as well, just because I get to take the dog home and immediately unload this knowledge on top of the pet parent, but we provide both.
So do you advertise it, like that you are doing upland training there in Indianapolis, or how do you work the marketing portion of it?
So when it comes to upland training, we did originally start marketing it once I felt a little bit more comfortable with my skills in that department. And that was also before I got my personal bird dog. And so currently we don't market for it. I'm not going to lie. I get a little bit selfish with my dog training time when it comes to Shug. So when it comes to upland right now, she's kind of my main focus. And then in the upland training, we more or less get together with clients who are interested in starting down the upland journey. And okay. We just pick their brains, you know, what are their goals? What can we do to help them out along this journey? And really, more or less, we're just there as a sounding board for those clients to kind of, if they have questions, they can come to us. If they need resources like birds or launchers, stuff like that, that's really where we're helping people out right now.
Okay. How far do you guys have to get, like drive it from Indianapolis for public hunting land? Is there a lot of it around there?
Public, you know, There is not too much. Okay. There are places, you know, I think that was our number one difficulty was where are these places and how do we get to them? Especially for the fact that, you know, I did all this planning to get a bird dog, and then just so my vehicle gave out and I couldn't actually get to the places we wanted to go to keep furthering her training. So There's not a whole lot of public places, but fortunately we found a lot of people who have offered us training space. So we definitely do have places to go to.
Do you guys have a local NAVDA chapter or any like clubs of any sort that you are training with?
Yeah. So fortunately we have two NAVDA chapters near us. So we have Central Indiana and we have Columbus, Indiana, which is called Hoosier Hills. So Hoosier Hills is a little bit who we're more active with. They're both the same distance from us, but you know, there are a lot of girls in the Hoosier Hills, so it's nice to go hang out with the bird dogging ladies. Sure. But you know, definitely utilize getting to work with those chapters for training.
Tell me a little bit about how you got into the bird dog portion of it. How did that come about in your life? Did you grow up with some exposure or hunting?
You know, no, I didn't. I always wanted to. I grew up in a town where, you know, deer season came around and the classrooms kind of emptied out. Everyone goes on their little family trips. And that's kind of what sparked my interest. Just, you know, it seemed like a fun family thing to do. But I never got to. I always asked my parents if I could do hunter safety, and they thought I was crazy. Like, there's no real way you want to do this. So they didn't really foster that interest when I was younger. Sure. But I did end up early off into my pet sitting career. I had a client that had 5 German short hairs, and he is an avid hunter. And he's kind of what re-sparked my interest, getting to be around him and pardon me, and his dogs, and just kind of seeing, you know, the interactions that he has with them in the hunting fields. And, you know, my friend Alicia said it the best way, which is it just kind of seems so romantic, you know, getting to go out with this dog and do this sport. So
sure.
He actually,
I love that.
Isn't it? It just seems like something like right off the movies. So mm-hmm. He told me about these different DNR programs that were run to help women get prepared to be in the outdoors. So I did that 1 year, and I took hunter safety before I went, just so I could get out there and start handling the guns. That's where I first learned to shoot shotgun, handguns, and rifles. And by the end of that weekend, I was in love with shotguns. I knew I wanted one. I knew whatever I was going to do hunting wise had to involve shotguns.
Sure.
So it took me a little bit, but then I finally got my first shotgun for Christmas that year from my dad, which is like the best gift he ever gave me. And then I was like, you know, I think I could do this as at least a hobby. You know, I could get a bird dog, train her, and just, I knew I wanted to do a sport with the dog. So it seemed like the perfect thing to do. So that's where I kind of finally started, okay, let me learn more about the bird dogging world, what it has to offer, the different, you know, subgroups of bird dogging, whether it's, you know, hunt tests, field trials, getting out on wild birds, what have you, and then what kind of breed I want. And yeah, that's what started everything.
So how did you decide on, so is Shug a English setter or a Llewellyn setter?
She's an English setter.
Okay, so how did you decide on an English setter?
So she was actually my backup breed. my original breed I wanted was a Bracco. I just love the look of them. They are something, you know, they're so different. They're so unique. And I'm not going to lie, you know, being a city girl trying this new sport, I kind of wanted something that stuck out as much as I did. And Braccos were just these beautiful, big, elegant, you know, just gentle face dogs. And, you know, 2020 was a crazy year, and the breeder I really wanted to go to, just things weren't going to work out. And I knew if I couldn't go to her that I wasn't going to go to my second, third, or fourth choice. I wanted to go to that person. So I went to my backup breed, and I was able to get my first breeder in mind for that breed. And that was the English setter.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Which just,
so are Bracco. I just haven't got one yet.
Well, good, good. You'll have to add one to your pack then soon, because you're right. And I think people that can appreciate the breed and their unique characteristics are true gems in themselves.
Yeah.
Not that I'm biased or anything.
Oh,
but
not at
yeah.
all.
So you are bringing to light a lot of the struggles that I hear about so often, and I had myself, including when we started out in hunting, was living in town and not having those resources and tools immediately at hand. And, you know, whether somebody's starting out and doesn't have all the launchers and the homing pigeons, there's a lot of pieces to this puzzle. And, you know, listeners are asking often, can you have an episode about how to train your bird dogs when you live in town? Because that is the majority of people that have them. And, you know, in addition to going to training days, maybe once a month, everybody's anxious to do more, learn more, and get out there with their dog. So I'm super eager to kind of jump into what it is you're doing with these challenges of living right in Indianapolis. And I've seen some of your photos, and I think what you're doing is super cool and innovative. But talk to us about that a little bit, what you're doing there, right in your own backyard.
I know, right? So I'm literally just sitting at a very busy intersection right now in my car talking. Like, yeah, this really is the city, isn't it? I really do forget it at times that we are in the city. And, you know, I am a planner by nature. I don't do anything based off a whim. You know, I like to take time, do my research, plan things out. You know, I think it's the easiest way to make things achievable is to go into it with a plan and a good time frame of when you want to achieve certain things by. So for me, you know, this all started well before I got my own bird dog. It was about 2 to 3 years of preparation. It can get expensive. You know, if you go out and try and get everything there is to start off a dog, your bank account's not going to be too happy with you. So it took us 3 years of saying, okay, listening to, you know, your podcast or other podcasts and figuring out what people have to say about keeping pigeons and, you know, things to start your dog off. And we just had to take our time and accumulate those things slowly before getting a bird dog. So fortunately, having bird dog clients and people that were just willing to let me collect hours of knowledge and experience by working with their dog, it gave me the time to say, okay, I need this to further this dog, or, you know, I got this and I never ended up using it. It was a, you know, worthless item to add to the list. So it just took time and adjusting as I went. So, you know, when it came to bringing in a dog of my own, we weren't being stopped by, okay, well, we don't have birds at this point in time, or we don't have access to land. Because those are the things that, you know, if you don't have them immediately ready for you when you need them, they're going to stop your process. They're going to stop your momentum of training. They're going to, you know, it's the same way you train a dog to do sit or stay or anything else. You have to keep building them. And if you stop, you know, you're going to have a little bit of a backslide there. So we really just had to take our time, get all the supplies we could, make really good connections with people near us and around us that have the same hobby and interest, so we can trade resources and, you know, utilize what each other have. And that's where, you know, when it came to bird dog training itself as a marketable job for me, you know, I found it was just best that I just have these resources for other people who are around me to be able to keep their dog progressing. So that would be my biggest takeaway is, you know, if it's something you're interested in doing and you don't have the dog yet, or you have the time to wait, take your time and accumulate those supplies and get the birds. You know, you can't train a bird dog without birds. So whether you're in the city or the country, you have to have birds at your disposal. So,
and so what are you doing for birds? I mean, I know, you know, when we lived in town, we're going out at farms and catching birds in the silos. And I know people that in busy towns, they go under, you know, the bypass and they're catching pigeons under the bridge. So what are you guys doing to get birds?
Yeah. So we started the same way, you know, making cardboard box traps. Like I would look up on YouTube, like how to make, you know, little pigeon traps, and we'd set them up at different bypasses. And, you know, we weren't getting a lot of birds that way. But fortunately, I did find a woman who is about 30 minutes away from me who raises pigeons and doves. So I do have a steady connection for those birds. And I mean, she has hundreds. Nice. So at any time I need them, or if I need to send someone her way, she definitely has them available. You know, same with quail. I have a friend in McCordsville who, you know, which is about 30 minutes away from me, who constantly has quail. Or if she doesn't and she's about to go get some, she knows, hey, you know, I'm going to shoot off a text to a couple people, see if they need any birds. So it's really just about, you know, finding those connections and finding people who can also offer up those connections to you.
Right.
So we definitely have, you know, our homing pigeons. We just got a whole bunch of new ones yesterday. And then we also keep quail around. I love the quail. The quail in city life, they recall so well.
That's so awesome. Do you have like a little Johnny house in your backyard, or how do you do that?
Yeah. So we have it on the side of our house. So, you know, when I first got them, I actually left the door open and they all got out that same day. And I was so upset. Like, I was literally in tears. My husband was like, wow, my wife's really crying over like 30 quail right now.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. You know, I was like, yeah, that's valuable training stuff. So,
for sure.
But you know, we ended up going to the store and I came back and they were all right back in the coop. Like, I was like, this is amazing. They're all here, counted their heads. They're here. So then I realized, okay, you know, if I don't take too many male out at a time, you know, and I just use these females, they recall each other back to the coop. So we fortunately have a little pocket of forest area near our house. So if we go plant birds there, we know in a couple days, they're going to come right back.
Nice. Wow. You're really lucky that way. What about shooting? I imagine that if you're shooting in town, you're going to have some issues there.
I'm too fond of primer pistols. So, right. You know, we're still very much in the learning process. You know, by no means will I say that I'm some expert bird dogger. I'm learning and having a blast, you know, talking about the journey as I'm learning. And that was, you know, one of the first things I learned is primer pistol, not good in neighborhood. I was so excited to get it. I loaded it up and I took it out front and shot it off and immediately ran back inside. So just upset with myself, like, wow, that sounded like a real gunfire, you know? So that's when we found out about the bullwhips, which can simulate, you know, a lighter gunfire. So if we do need to work with any gunfire in the city, we bring out the bullwhip.
A bullwhip. Okay. Yeah. That's the first I've heard of that. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. You know, I, at first, you know, once again, as a force free trainer, was like, oh my gosh, a bullwhip, what are they doing with that? And then I learned a little bit more about it, and it's just to help simulate that pop of a gun. So, you whip it out and it's going to give you that nice crack you need just to kind of work with young dogs on gunfire. And yeah, it helps simulate it.
Sure. And the dog's like, oh shit, I don't want to mess with her. She's got a big bullwhip in her hand.
I was like, yeah, what are we using these for? And, you know, she had a great video on it. And I'm like, oh, okay. That makes a lot more sense. So, you know, and even a couple cut down pieces of 2x4, you clap those together, makes a nice, you know, not exactly a gunfire, but that just that loud noise that a dog can expect when there's a bird present.
What about the other things you're doing, like steadiness? How are you training for steadiness?
So steadiness, you know, it's that controversial topic of launchers. You know, we do like to use launchers to teach steadiness, especially when it comes to pointing steadiness, you know, to point. It's something that, you know, for positive reinforcement or for force-free, what we operate under is we are adding something to make a behavior more likely to happen, or we're using negative punishment to make, we're taking something away to make a behavior less likely to happen. So when it comes to steadiness, we're using that launcher to add something. So if you are staying steady as a dog, we're adding you getting to be around this bird. You're still in the presence of the bird. You get to take in all that scent you know, that huge serotonin high that dogs get from just being able to take in that smell of bird. And then if you creep, if you move, we launch the bird. So we're taking away that bird, which, you know, the hopes in doing that and, you know, what we have been able to achieve with that is our dog staying still longer just to stay in that presence of the bird as long as possible.
What about for water? Do you do any water work or swimming with them?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the perks of being in an urban environment is we have a lot of different facilities at our disposal. And, you know, by no means as a dog trainer am I not willing to seek out more help. So we have what's called Alpha Canine. It's about 10 minutes down the road from us, and it is a giant dog facility. They do a number of different training, but they also offer dock diving and swimming classes there. So being that Shug was, pardon me, you know, especially since Shug has been my main focus with bird dog training lately, during the spring, we were able to, well, we got her in the summer. So we were able to do some water work, just, you know, exposure, positive association, getting her around it, you know, splashing during those months. But it got pretty cold fast here in Indiana. So, you know, like I said, if you stop things, you know, you stop that momentum and it gets kind of hard to keep progressing your dog. So we knew we didn't want to take the whole winter without water work. So we signed up for their dock diving classes. I'm like, yeah, you know, if she can dock dive during the winter in this indoor environment, she can definitely swim come springtime. And
right.
You know, the classes really didn't go the way we expected. She jumped in the water once the whole time, and it was like the last class. But they do still put them in the water, get them swimming, encouraging them to swim across the pool. So literally, we were like, all right, it's warming up. Let's go back to the outdoor places. And I can already see that her confidence has shot up since the winter months. I mean, she's going out and retrieving 100% of the time out the water now. So, you know, to urban people, I would definitely suggest finding places that offer swim classes, especially during your winter months. You want to keep it's anything else you would work with. You want to keep up with it. You want to stay consistent. But yeah, fortunately, we have a river right through town and a whole bunch of different lakes and creeks around us that she can get just, you know, playtime and swimming time in whenever she wants.
Yeah. And I mean, English setters aren't really known to be huge lovers of water and swimming in general. So how has that process been going?
So I was actually talking about this yesterday. You know, her breeder sent me a message reminding me that the dogs she breeds are natural swimmers, natural retrievers, and, you know,
famous last words.
It comes back to that natural ability versus desire, you know, just because this is something that she can be genetically capable of doesn't necessarily mean that she has a desire to want to do it. So you kind of have to take that natural ability and just create those positive associations to make it something desirable to do. So yeah, I mean, she's a birdaholic. So once I throw a bird in the water, she will do anything to get to that bird. So
that's awesome.
Fortunately, we do have that going for us. But, you know, she's 9 months old. You know, we kept at it. We keep at it. We don't stop. You know, there are no bad days. There's just, you learn from each time you go out and you adjust and keep moving. So mm-hmm. Same thing with swimming. We have to just, okay, well, she didn't swim today. You know, what was the water temperature like? Or, you know, what was the weather outside? You know, were there distractions? And then we have to reassess and try again.
Let's talk about your force-free approach in training. You know, this is something that is so controversial in bird dog training in general, but I think on the same token, it's more and more common. I think we're really trying to get over that whole let's pinch the ear, throw an e-collar, force them to piles, you know, do that. I just think we're not there anymore. You know, the way we keep dogs is completely different than what was in the past, and the transition training demeanor is changing with the times. And so why have you personally decided to use this approach of a force-free training, and explain to us a little bit about what that means?
Yeah. So, you know, when you go through the certification process of becoming a dog trainer, one of the first things you learn about are the four quadrants of operant conditioning, which are going to be positive reinforcement, negative reinforcement, positive punishment, and negative punishment. And those four quadrants are where most dog trainers are going to find their solutions to whatever behavioral issues they're having. So when it comes to force-free training, it is the same thing as positive reinforcement. It's just a better, less controversial name to it. But what we're focusing on once again is adding something to make a behavior more likely to happen. And there's still punishment that we do, but it's the negative punishment of we're removing something to make behavior less likely to happen. So when it comes to, you know, a lot of the lessons that we learn for certification, a lot of it's designed around those two quadrants. So it's one of those things where, you know, it's what I've learned. It's what I'm comfortable with. It's what my personal dog is comfortable with. You know, setters are kind of like Vishlas in the sense of they're soft dogs and they can only handle so much adverse, you know, punishment before you completely just make them melt. So it works great for my personal dog. I by no means am one of those, you know, shaming trainers of, you know, my way is the best way or, you know, you're doing it wrong. Because fact of the matter is, we're a part of a giant wheel of dog training. And there's a spoke for each and every one of us. It's just one of those things where, like you said, the more we advance our dogs and the more our dogs become family to us, the more careful we want to be with how we choose to work with those dogs and, you know, also publicly work with those dogs. Mm-hmm. It's a great way to keep a bond with your dog. Like I said, you know, if I did ear pinching or toe hitches with Shug, she probably wouldn't look me in my eyes for at least a month. Like her soul would be hurt, you know? So it's just one of those things where it's worked for me. It's worked for all the clients I've worked with. It's, you know, made a difference for clients who maybe have tried other forms of training before and have still met their dogs with, wow, I still have this behavioral issue and, you know, what can I do now? So it's just, it's not necessarily the only way to train. It's just one of the four quadrants that you can pick. So when it comes to why I do it, you know, I think bird dogging's for everyone. You know, I think a lot of people do tend to turn away from hunting and sporting dogs in general because of the harsh imagery that they see around the sport. So I think to have another form of training as an option to these people that I want to do this, but I don't want to do that to my dog, or I don't want to train my dog, you know, in this traditional sense, it gives them a way to be a part of the sport without thinking that maybe they're damaging their bond with their dog.
Do you feel that there still needs to be a course or a repercussion of negative reinforcement with a positive approach?
I mean, I think there is, you know, a lot of what I've learned has come from traditional trainers. And there's only very small changes that are made between what I do and what maybe they do. So it's one of those things where I was a vegan for 3 years and I never once told anyone, you know, why I think they should become a vegan, why it's going to be good for them. You know, I think that people kind of learn as they go, you know, it's, you know, I don't know if there should be punishment or recourse, but, you know, because shaming's never a way to stop anything, you know, so it's one of those things where all I can do is present this other route and hopefully more people start seeing the benefit of taking this route while there's also the route.
Sure. So tell me what you're doing like, give me an example of one of the things that you've trained in a bird dog aspect.
Yeah.
With Shug, that was the positive or force-free approach.
Yeah. So, I mean, everything up until this point, you know, I would say the most beneficial part would be recall. You know, especially when it comes to AKC, you don't get to have that remote in your hand to correct your dog if they're e-collar trained. So that's probably one of the biggest things that I heard a lot of people say that they would have done differently is, you know, done more recall without the e-collar, having their dog truly understand when I say come or when I say here, I need you to come back to me. So I knew off bat recall was something I definitely wanted to work on with her from the get-go with just positive reinforcement. Because my worst fear has always been, we're going to get to a hunt test or we're going to, you know, because I do understand why people with bird dogs utilize e-collars at times. You know, we're constantly changing the environment this dog is in, and each environment presents its own distractions and dangers to it. So I understand, you know, the safety crutch of the e-collar, because, you know, when you set your dog loose in these fields and you see them just take off, You know, you worry about, am I going to really get my dog back at the end of this?
Right. Right.
You know, e-collar, conditioning, you know, I get it. But I definitely knew, you know, AKC, I can't use it. I need her to be able to understand when I say come, I mean come. Mm-hmm. So we started out as puppy using targeting, which is, you know, luring your puppy to come to your hand. We slowly upgraded her just same way you do anything else. We started in quiet environments, you know, just in the living room, my husband and I calling her back and forth, moved that to the backyard, same thing out there, practice calling her off distractions. So, you know, planting treats on the ground and getting her to ignore the treat and come back to us. And there's different drills that you can do. Like there's the elastic recall technique where you're throwing a nice high value reward to each side of you and calling your dog back this direction to you. And I mean, it was 7 months of labor and positive reinforcement. So by no means am I going to say positive reinforcement is an easy overnight, you know, way to train your dog. It takes time. It takes diligence. It takes, you know, consistency to get them there. But, you know, fortunately I can now have her off leash in most environments and know that if I tell her here, she's going to stop what she's doing and come back to me. Which also, you know, for positive reinforcement, we had to utilize high value rewards. We had to, you know, anytime we're changing the environment, meaning, you know, there's new environmental reinforcers that are probably going to make her less likely to come to us. Well, we know we have to bring the extra high value rewards that time. So typically what we use are sardines. She loves sardines. If she hears me say here, she will stop and turn on a dime for one of her sardines.
I've never heard of that. Are you getting like the sardines and tomato paste in the little tin?
Yeah, we get the sardines. Can and just for water, and I have to picture her on a spoon and everything because it's so messy and so nasty. I walk around smelling like sardines all the time.
How did you come across that? Like, how does that even happen?
You know, high value reward, you know, well, the reward system is a big part of positive reinforcement. So, you know, and that's where people kind of think that we're bribing dogs sometimes. But what we're doing is using a reward system that has different values to it. So if I'm working with my dog inside or in the backyard, I have a low value reward, maybe like a piece of dog kibble or a training treat, something like that. And as those environments change, we kind of keep upping it. So maybe one day I use shredded chicken for this environment, you know, the next high distraction environment I'm using pulled beef. And then, you know, okay, I really need her to listen. I have the sardines out today. And it's really a matter of listening to your dog, like, hey, what do you consider high value? You know, because, you know, a cheeseburger may be high value to me, but that may not be what she considers high value. So it's really just a matter of figuring out what your dog goes apeshit for and using that to your advantage.
Yeah. Okay. So tell me, in these three different scenarios, sorry, I'm putting you to the test here, Melinda. In these three different scenarios, what are you going to do as a positive only trainer? So you have a recall, mm-hmm. you call the dog doesn't come to you. Or situation number two, you tell the dog to fetch, the dog mm-hmm. doesn't retrieve. Situation mm-hmm. number three, you tell the dog to woe and the dog busts the bird. What are you doing in those?
So honestly, you know, when it comes to active situation, the same thing another trainer is going to do. You know, if I'm out and I'm doing recall and dog isn't listening, all I can do at that point in time is get to that dog, get her put up, and we're done. You know, I can't keep letting her run around. I can't keep letting her go because she's not listening. So she's self-reinforcing. So she's conditioning herself to not listen to my recall. So at that point in time, I have to do what I can to get a hold of that dog, which obviously isn't chasing her. It's not, you know, reprimanding her once I get to her, because that's never gonna make her want to come to me at all. So the best I can do is say, all right, we're done for the day. I'm going to collect you and put you away. And how we do that is by body language. So if she is now, okay, I'm not going to recall, I'm in a game of catch me or don't catch me, I'm going back to the vehicle. I'm going to move on, do the next thing I was going to do, whether that's, you know, putting my gun away, you know, cleaning up, and get her to come in. Once she comes in, I put her away and we're done.
Okay. So you don't do the end on a good note thing then. You just, when, if they're doing something wrong, you're just putting them up.
So when it comes to that recall, yes. So
okay.
on a good note, we have to be in a structured situation. So the biggest thing to remember when it comes to positive reinforcement is we do a lot of extinction of behaviors and proofing of behaviors, which means if my dog hasn't showed me that she's recalling 100%, she never gets to be in the position to not listen. So we have to get her to 100% before we let her off and let her go. So what that, and that's the extinction of things, is okay, I'm going to keep at this until I see this behavior is not happening before I put her to the test of mm-hmm. will you or won't you. So we can end on a good note when it comes to actual training, but since we are still in training, we are using check cords to be able to get a dog back to us, or different things that can let the training proceed. But if we're in an active situation and she's not listening, all I can do is pack it up, call it a day. And okay. ending on a good note could be something as simple as, okay, she's finally back to me. Let's do a quick sit. All right, good job. You've sat. I'm putting you away, you know.
Okay.
And the fortunate thing about ending on a good note is, you know, we really consider it anything that's not just getting straight up upset with your dog, you know. If she gets to me at the car and I'm just, you know, frustrated and, you know, flailing around, grabbing her, throwing her in, you know, that's ending on a bad note. You know, it's one of those things where I, as a positive reinforcement trainer, if she wasn't 100%, you know, performing her recalls and training, there's no reason why she should even be off leash in an active situation.
Okay. Okay. So what about situation number two?
Number two, is that fetching?
Yeah. Yep.
So fetching, you know, same thing. We start out small. So now I would say, I'm talking about all this and like, if we're in an active situation, but it sounds like we're talking more about training. So I'll talk about this one as more of, you know, in a training session. Yeah. So if we're working on our fetching, first thing we're doing, whether it's recall, fetching, anything, is we're doing a warm up every time. We're not starting at where we start, where we ended our last session. We're taking a couple steps back, warming up, making sure that she's still making those connections of what the job is at hand. So, you know, for fetching, before we start throwing out a bumper, we're going to start on her placement board with some take it. You know, is she taking it? Is she holding it? Is she dropping it when I tell her drop it? Is there anything that we need to work on here that she's not doing 100% before we move forward to fetching? So if during our warm up, she's showing me, hey, I'm picking it up off the board, I'm putting it in your hand, I'm taking it willingly when you tell me to take it, well, then we can move forward to fetching. So, you know, we start out little bit by little bit. You know, we're not launching the dummy 70 yards, you know, We tend to just throw it off a couple of feet from the placement board, and we work up to that every session. So by the end of the session, we can start throwing it more long distance and getting those good retrieves in. And once again, if she gets to the point where, okay, mom's going to throw it out 20 yards and she goes out, gets it, doesn't bring it back, well, then I bring her back into the board and we do the warm up again. You know, we just see, okay, you did all these things really well, but that last thing you didn't do too well. Let's take a couple steps back, work on these things again, and then move forward.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Good. What about situation number three, unsteadiness, when you are telling her to whoa and she breaks on a bird?
Yeah. So that's the hardest one, you know, and that's really what hung us up on our first hunt test too. We got out on that first run and she busted bird number one. And then you come to this, okay, crap, you know, is she going to do this the rest of the time? Because if she is, I'm willingly letting her condition herself into busting birds, which is, you know, the one thing we don't want happening when we're out hunting with our dog. Right. So in that situation, if she is busting birds and they're planted birds, we're going to have to take a step back, put the launcher out, put the bird in the launcher, you know, and sometimes it can be, you know, okay, maybe it was a quail she busted on. She knows quail don't fly off as fast as doves do or pigeons do. So maybe we need to swap the bird real quick to something she can't get a hold of. And through her realizing, okay, well, this bird I can't get a hold of, let me just stay steady a little longer. But most of the time, what we would do is just go ahead and say, okay, in a training situation, she's busting, let's get out the launcher. Let's go ahead, work her on the launcher a little bit, refresh her memory, do a little warm up, show her, hey, you don't move means bird gets to stay, means you get to stay in the company of this bird. So that's what we would do. We would just back it up to launchers.
Okay, good. I'm not trying to give you a hard time and hard press. I'm genuinely interested in hearing, you know, how you're working through those situations with that approach. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no. I mean, recall would be the same way. You know, at first I'm talking about in like, if we're at a hunt test, if we're out hunting, you know, what I would do if she wasn't recalling. Unfortunately, yeah, right. our trip would get packed up and put away. But yeah, for recall, it would be the same thing. Okay, she's not recalling in this new environment. We need to back up to a calmer environment, you know, get out that high value reward, do more practice before we increase any distractions or environment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what about when she's like mid pooping on the floor? Do you even give her like a verbal ah-ah, or is that considered negative reinforcement?
So it's, you know, that's one of those cross subjects there. I will sit here and say, I have an ah-ah. I am an ah-ah-er.
Okay.
It's an instilled thing within me. You know, I've been probably doing it as long as I've ever had dogs. So it's pretty much a tick at this point that I'm not going to be able to get rid of. So if that's now considered, you know, punishment, you know, I guess I'm no longer a force-free trainer.
But, you know, but that brings up, you know, that just that other aspect of it, because is there a negative? And that, you know, in what you were explaining there, there's a lot of positive, and that's, you know, but there's these other situations where what happens when, what do you do? How do you respond? So.
Exactly. And, you know, I think the thing to remember when it comes to positive reinforcement is that there's the second half of it, which is negative punishment. So, you know, negative punishment when it comes to pooping on the floor would just be removing your dog from the situation to poop on the floor. So if it was her and she is showing me that, okay, you're having accidents inside, well, that means that I'm now limiting that freedom you get. So I do stop them in the moment. I'm not, you know, maybe an ah-ah-ah comes out and pick them up, put them outside real quick. But there's definitely the second part that has to come of, you know, now that I've told my dog what not to do, I need to tell her what she is doing correctly. So now that she has pottied outside, I'm giving her her verbal praise and food reward to mark that that was what I wanted. And that ah-ah-ah moment was not what I wanted.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, no, that makes total sense. And I appreciate you digging into that for me.
For sure.
I think that, you know, because it's, if somebody is 100% positive reinforcement, that, you know, that's what gets me, is if your dog's pooping on the floor.
Yeah.
How do you positively reinforce them to not do it?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So I would definitely say, if you are, you know, interested in positive reinforcement, and it's something that you are starting to learn about, and it, you know, you're excited to start it, there has to be the understanding that there is still punishment involved. There is still negative punishment. If you want positive reinforcement, you have to employ negative punishment. Mm-hmm. You know, just like we tell people, you know, you can't train your dog by constantly telling them what they're doing wrong. You have to eventually start telling them what they are doing right. And, you know, that's vice versa. You know, you can't just tell your dog what they're doing right without highlighting those moments that they're doing something wrong.
Right. And I look at, you know, mothering, I think moms are amazing in general, but yeah. You look at that natural instincts with our bitches. You know, if their puppies are being naughty, if they're biting on them, chewing on them, whatever it might be, you know, those moms are giving them a little roar. And they're, that's the negative punishment right there. And so, you know, they're not going, oh, good job, keep biting my nipples. That feels amazing. Right.
And, you know, and that's, you know, where socialization with dogs start, right? Mm-hmm. With mom, with pack mates, you know, people say that, you know, socialization starts at 8 weeks, but, you know, puppies are still learning bite inhibition, you know, when they're still with mom, and, you know, how hard is too hard when suckling, and, you know, how hard is too hard when playing with my 4-week-old litter mates. So, yeah, right. Socialization's always happening for these dogs.
Right. Yeah. I mean, even nursing with my kid, I'm like, first time that happened, I went, ah! And I don't think he ever did it again after that.
I don't want to do that again.
That's not going to happen.
Love it. But, you know, I mean, positive reinforcement, negative punishment, it's parenting at the end of the day, you know, and I think that's the best way to look at training with your dog is, it's, you know, it's nice to say, okay, well, I want a bird dog, or I want this out of my dog. But really, at the end of the day, all we're striving to do is make a good line of communication with our dog. We just want to be able to tell them the things that are desirable and the things that aren't desirable, and be able to ask them for those desirable things on cue when we need them.
Right. A little bit ago, you mentioned your first hunt test, and I really want to touch on that, because what is it exactly that made you even want to start testing your dog for hunting?
It's, you know, hunting and testing, I think it's all, it's a test to both of us, you know, as a positive reinforcement trainer or a force-free trainer. You constantly feel like you're you're being tested, you know, whether it's, you know, working with clients who just aren't too familiar with the techniques, or trying to explain to traditional trainers your approach, or, you know, everyone's always kind of sitting back watching, like, okay, well, let's see how this really works. So I think when we thought of testing, I wanted to just put us both to the test. I wanted to see, you know, how far can I get this dog based off of the methods that I believe to work? And how far, you know, and that also speaks to me as a trainer, how far I can get her shows what I'm doing actually works. So that's the main reason we started. And, you know, now that I have an English setter, I'm in love with the breed. I think that happens once you just, you know, find that heart dog. And so I really just want to do whatever she shows she's good at. You know, she is a dog that has a hardwired, bred, you know, natural ability in her. You know, it's one of those things where I know she wouldn't be just happy as an urban dog. She has to be able to do the job she's bred to in some capacity. So, you know, hunt testing, field trialing, NAVDA, all these things sounded like wonderful routes to take her on. I remember one guy was like, you know, this is going to cost a lot of money if you do all these things. And it just kind of, it's like your kids, you know, you want to just let them do whatever they show that they love and that they're good at. And so we figured hunt testing would be a definite, you know, first step for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, I think you touched on something interesting there too, because I hear so much feedback of why, of people being called out of, why are you testing your dog? Why do you have it in this evaluation if you're never even going to hunt it? And, mm-hmm. and I think that is such a step backwards from where we need to be and be completely aware of what we're saying, because yes. I think there's over, I don't know what, 75%. I don't know. I'm putting a number out there, but sure. I think so many of us started in that venue. I know I did personally. I think between my husband and I was the first one that tested a dog in NAFDA, and I did the hunt test even though I didn't hunt, but it was that step of finding that enjoyment in those venues that took me into the that person of being a hunter.
Yeah.
And but in addition to that, I mean, what is, you know, what's something that you could add to that of, if the dog is never actually going to hunt, why should people consider going to these hunt tests or NAFDA tests or VDD tests, whatever it might be that your breed can do?
Yeah, I think first and foremost is understanding that there's hundreds of different sporting dog events out there. So, you know, even if you don't have a sporting dog to do sporting events in, it's worth figuring out what your dog enjoys to do and figuring out how to keep them active in that event. You know, most breeds were bred for specific jobs, and a lot of those breeds, their jobs no longer exist. But there are a whole bunch of different sports that simulate and reenact these, you know, different jobs that used to exist. So these dogs are able to continue to use these hardwired, you know, genetic traits that are within them that aren't going anywhere. You know, this is part of who your dog is. So if it's something that they're bred to do and they enjoy doing, find them that job, that sport to do. So when it comes to sporting dogs, I think, you know, especially if you're in an urban setting and, you know, maybe you don't hunt, it's, you're seeing those hardwired behaviors somewhere, whether it's, you know, Fido chasing the cat around the house, or, you know, pointing every bird on your walk, or, you know, just that relentless chase when you're in the dog park and you know, you just can't call them back because that squirrel means so much to them. It's those reasons that people should consider sporting. You know, it's not your dog being bad. It's your dog doing what it's supposed to do. It's just not in a facilitated way. So sporting with your dog is just going to be able to let your dog engage in natural behaviors and, you know, let you work with your dog, continue bonding with your dog. You know, it's definitely worth it, you know, for whoever you are.
Right. Yeah, I completely agree with you. I love what you just said there. What are some ways that you personally prepared for the hunt test? I mean, were you reading the AKC rule book? Did you ask people how did you prepare for that?
I spent 3 years preparing for
it. No way. So,
no, it's one of those things where, I like being prepared for everything, you know? So before I got my dog and I started thinking about, okay, well, you know, what are these different chapters of bird dogging? You know, like you said, NAFDA, AKC, you know, all the other ones that are out there, because there's so many. Mm-hmm. What are these different chapters? And let me go see what they're like. Let me travel around, experience these different groups and walk braces and talk to judges and, you know, learn from other people about what they've learned by doing this. So that's the first thing I did. I just read rule books. And I mean, I even first made our Urban Uplander Instagram as just a way for me to connect with other bird doggers on Instagram and ask them questions and get some information about what I need to be doing to prepare myself. So, you know, I'm not saying you have to take 3 years in advance, but, you know, just going out and watching an event, it's free to do. You know, they're everywhere across the country, especially if you're talking about AKC events. There's a whole calendar right on their website. But just to go and interact with people and see what it's really about would be the first thing I would do. You know, obviously reading rule books, but, you know, nothing compares to real life experience. You know, I spent, like I said, 3 years of just learning and getting all this knowledge, and, you know, knowledge is nothing without the personal experience behind it.
So when you got there, was it overwhelming? Like, what were you feeling like as you pulled into the parking lot? And for the listeners, you know, a normal hunt test is a hunt test on Saturday and one on Sunday. And Melinda decided to jump into it like real hardcore and entered a double double. So, which means that there's two clubs that each hold a test, usually in fields that are on really close to each other, but on options. So you're going from one run in the morning to one run in the afternoon instead of just once a day. So you had four runs in 2 days. So when you pulled into that parking lot, were you like, okay, I'm ready for this? Was that vision they had beforehand what kind of came into play?
No. So okay. I'm so anxious, you know, it's that excitement built with that nervousness, you know what I mean? Just we're excited to finally be here. You know, and the fortunate part was where we went was a place that I went to 2 years ago to watch hunt tests, you know, to kind of learn and talk with judges. And so it was like a new milestone of, okay, now we're back to participate. So there was definitely that excitement there, but you know, we've been training pretty consistently. And the weekend before we went out there, she had a bad weekend. I'm not going to lie. She was busting birds left and right. And you know, I think everyone there was looking at me like, are you sure you want to go do this hunt test? And you know, so I reached out to one of the bird dog forums on Facebook and, you know, just kind of asked other people about how their first experience went and, you know, any words of advice to get me to actually get in my car and go do this thing. Cause, you know, I started getting a little nervous, and the theme behind what everyone said was have fun and just get the experience. Don't worry about ribbons. Don't worry about titling. Just have fun, you know? So by the time we got there, my nerves had calmed a little bit. I'm not going to lie. I was so anxious the whole ride there. We got there the night before and we actually stayed in my vehicle. So I was able to kind of take the evening to decompress those jitters out of me. But yeah, we were anxious. It was a lot of nervousness and a lot of excitement just combating each other.
Yeah. It's a lot to prepare for. I mean, mentally, I think sometimes more than physically with the dog.
Yeah. Yeah.
First time with anything. So tell us about the test. What happened? You had two tests the first day, two tests the second day.
Yeah. Two tests the first, two tests the second. So first run, I could have peed my pants. I was so nervous. It was, you know,
because but you did it, right? You did it.
I so didn't. That's a fortunately, okay, I did not bring too many pants with me too. So fortunately, good. I did not. But it was, you know, once again, just one of those culmination moments of, wow, we're here. You know, I waited so long to get the puppy and work with the puppy, and now she's here and about to do her first event. So, you know, but the main thing I was trying to remind myself is to stay calm. You know, dogs can definitely feel our energy. They can smell our stress through different hormones. So I knew if I wanted her to just go out and do this and have a good time, I had to calm down. I had to just take the pressure off myself, take the pressure off her, and just let her run, see how it goes. So we knew the first time out, I was going to let her loose, tell her find a bird, and sit back and shut my mouth and let my dog work. And that's what I did. And I'm telling you, she took off like a bat out of hell. She was running through the field aimlessly, you know, not patterning. She was behind me like for half of it. You know, she's supposed to be out in front of me. And, you know, what I realized is for me wanting to get into town so early and like decompress myself, I didn't realize I was voluntarily shacking my dog up. Like she was just pent up in her crate. Just, you know, nerves going and, you know, she didn't get to run and stretch her legs before. So this first run, she was like, I'm running, I'm stretching my legs, I'm having a good time. I do not care about anything else. So she ended up stumbling upon her first bird. She was not searching for it. It just all of a sudden was bird and she definitely busted in on it. She got a hold of it. Brought it back to me like, look, mom, look at my bird. And, you know, retrieving bird is something that we're still definitely working on. So I was like, oh, it's nice that she brought it back to me, but definitely not the way I was supposed to see this first run go. So unfortunately, we ended up scratching that first one, which was kind of disheartening. But once again, you know, reminding myself, hey, once again, we're just here for experience. This is, you know, just putting notches in our belt. So I took a moment to kind of shake it off. And, you know, the judge said she had some words for me later. And so I was able to talk with her. And she turns out to be like a master champion English setter breeder. So she had a lot to, you know, offer as far as advice.
Nice. But so she took the time afterwards to seek you out and talk to you?
She did. And, you know, the one thing she said, which, like I said earlier, if it came to my dog exhibiting a behavior time and time again, an undesirable behavior, I would have to say, all right, we got to pack it in. You're conditioning yourself to do this. I'm not going to reinforce this by letting you do this. So when she saw her bust that first run, you know, she did say, you know, if it was her dog, she would think about packing it up and calling it a weekend. Which, you know, it's just one of those things. It was hard to hear, but I understand as a trainer why it was said. Once again, if my dog is going to be busting birds all weekend, am I willingly going to keep letting her do this or should we go ahead and just head home? But, you know, thinking back once again to the forum, I'm here for experience. I'm not going to pack it up. I'm going to keep going. My spirit was a little crushed. I did sit in my car and cry for about 5 minutes, but you know, we shook it off and we got ready for our second run.
Okay. Okay. So how did the second run look, Melinda?
So the second, you know, I will say the theme of the rest of the weekend was she showed improvement run after run.
Interesting. Run, okay.
You know, and right. Interesting because, you yes. know, I'm also thinking, wow, she busted that bird when she got a hold of it. She's yes. probably going to do it again. The second one, she knows she can.
Absolutely. Why wouldn't she? Yep.
So we got out there. She found two birds that one on this run and she was holding her points. She was listening fairly well. You know, she knew they were actually running the junior in the same field test after test, which isn't something I think they typically do, but that worked to our advantage for the fact that she knew where we were going for birds. So she kind of got in her mind, okay, I know where I'm headed. So second run, she got out there. She found her two birds. She held her points. She listened well, and she ended up getting her ribbon that time.
Wow. So that is super interesting to me. And because, I mean, from the majority of experience of what happens typically, if a dog knows that they can run down and catch a bird, it's all downhill from there, right?
Yep.
So,
yep.
And that's the reason why you use homing pigeons. And I know like on double doubles, I mean, even advanced dogs, if they even have that one chance of catching that bird and getting that bad habit back, we would get them home the end of day one and just throw pigeons for them. So they realized again, don't catch the bird. I can't catch the bird. And
right.
then it would improve. So it's super rare that dogs go from chasing and catching to pointing again. And
I
you
know.
did you did nothing in between from morning to afternoon run?
Nothing besides let her rest. You know, I think to our advantage, she also was getting tired, you know? So I think that little bit of not exhaustion, but okay, I'm not as amped up and, you know, energetic kind of worked to our advantage. But you're right. That would be the norm of, wow, I did it once. I can do it again. And, you know, and that's like the perk over pigeons to quail is, you know, they're fast flying. They're going to take off and they're going to keep going, you know, unlike quail who are going to go up and come back down, which is still something we're working on with her. She knows at some point the quail will come down. So it's just a matter of, you know, continually working with that. But yeah, she definitely second time found two birds, showed improvement, pointed both of them. And even our third run, you know, we even saw just a little bit more improvement. Those points were becoming a little longer. She was chasing a little less and moving to the next bird. So, you know, and that third one was on Sunday morning. So I also wasn't too hopeful for the fact that we just woke up and, you know, she's once again energetic and ready to go. Right. But it seemed like she stopped hunting so much for herself and started hunting more for me. And I think the more I calmed down, the more she calmed down. So, and you know, being an anxious person by nature, I'm like, it's something I'm always reminding myself, just calm down, just settle down. So third one, she did great again, showed a little bit more improvement, ended up getting her ribbon. Fourth time the sun came out and it got hot and, you know, we're just now getting into those hot days. So she's not too well conditioned for that quite yet. So once again, I think that worked to our advantage of slowing her down. Her fourth run was amazing. You know, I, as anxious as I am, I'm also emotional. So I cry a bit. And I'm telling you, a little tear kept popping out every time I would see her like, hold her point for 10 seconds longer than the last one. And
you
know, these four songbirds took off and, you know, to see your dog not chase after them and get back to the hunt. And, you know, I kind of just got to see, wow, my puppy is actually maturing and not just, you know, over the past 7 months of having her, but right here this weekend in front of me, I'm watching my dog mature.
Right. Right. That is some incredible growth in 2 days there, girl.
Oh, wow. You're telling me I went in like, hey, we're going to title this weekend. We're getting forward to, oh my gosh, I hope my dog just comes back to me and, you know, doesn't bust any more birds and this becomes a normal thing. But, you know, she did show improvement. She showed progress, but, you know, even when you get your scores after each run and they kind of go over, and I think that's the great part about AKC and the judges is all of them are willing to offer up their constructive criticism. You know, if you want to know where you can improve or, you know, what they were seeing, they're more than happy to explain all of that to you. So
you have to ask. So, you know, for those that have never run AKC hunt test before, the scores are handed in, you either get a ribbon or not. And sometimes you don't know why you got that ribbon or why you didn't get a ribbon. So if you are curious, there's two judges out there. So, and go ask them. And I can say it's not like a dog show. If you go to a dog show and you ask them why you didn't get placed or why you didn't win, they don't want to tell you and they don't have to.
No.
So, and they usually
don't. I don't care why they can look at you like, why did you even ask me that? You know?
Right. I think, completely different feels. And, but you're right there. I don't know any hunt test judge I've ever run under, that wouldn't have taken the time to give me some tips and reasons why, that was a yes or a no on that scorecard. So I shouldn't say yes or no. It's
right. You know,
what the 0 to 10
is that for sure. And, you know, you're only doing yourself and your dog a disservice if you don't ask. You know, you especially for the fact that it's about the betterment of your dog and the betterment of these breeds, you know, you're going to want to ask. It's going to help you figure out where you need to improve yourself, your dog, and how to keep pushing forward. So we definitely make sure we talk to every judge afterwards and, you know, even during it. You know, I think that's, and I, you know, I don't know how it typically goes. We have another hunt test my birthday weekend, so we'll see working with new judges how it is. But, you know, I definitely got comfortable with kind of asking questions during it while focusing on my dog. Just, you know, being our first run, hey, am I doing this correctly? Am I, you know, approaching my dog correctly? You know, just things that you're going to want to know. It never hurts to ask.
Yep. And you absolutely can. And I think a lot of times the judges want to be there to help you. You know, you're starting out at that line and they're just hoping to give you passing scores. I don't know any that are looking to try to fail a dog. So
no,
they're always anxious to help and talk. I've never seen anything different. I think when you ask advice, you need to sometimes filter that out. I have heard some advice given as like, yeah.
Yeah, that was probably my biggest takeaway that evening was as I've mentioned, I'm a planner, I'm a student by nature. So I want to take in any advice and criticism that is given to me. But you have to filter through that, you know, because like I said, you know, as kind as the first judge was, if I would have just packed it up and gone home that weekend and thrown my hands up, I would have never got to see my dog mature right there that weekend.
Right.
Never passed our other.
You may have never even come back to another hunt test.
Bingo. I wouldn't have.
Right.
And I think that's the, you know, when it comes to why people should do this or who should do this, I think it's for anyone that has a real passion for advancing their dog, you know. And I kind of thought about just, you know, where the magic of what you say to people, why it's important. And, you know, especially in these settings, when you're talking to, you know, they don't know me from the next person. So understanding that this is her first time out and, you know, she's so excited isn't on their radar. So you don't know if what you're saying is now going to make me change my whole passion in life or, you know, find a new avenue to take my dog down. But yeah, I think it's one of those things that you get the advice as it comes and you figure out how to use all of it to your advantage. You know, it's, you know, even bad advice can be good advice if you figure out how to rewire it correctly.
Well, I'm super stoked that you didn't take the advice to pack it up. And I'm glad that you had that, you know, rest of a good weekend where you saw growth in your dog instead of the bad habits of, you know, continuing to just bust and not point birds. Because yeah, I just worry how many people that happens to and they just never come back. And not only that, because that affects maybe, you know, if you are planning on going to an AVDA test after that in a couple months, maybe you would have been like, you know what, the testing thing just isn't for me. I don't want to do it. And, or it may have even prevented you from being a hunter. And so I don't know. I think we need to be so aware of what is being said out there. Giving encouragement, because you're right. You don't know if it's somebody's 20th dog they're bringing to the line or their first dog. What kind of advice would you give to somebody that is going to a hunt test for their first time or preparing for one?
Same thing everyone told me, relax and have fun. you know, my emotional self is already tearing up. You know, I had so much fun with Shug that weekend. You know, it's just one of those things that if nothing else happens for you that weekend, if you don't get a ribbon, if you don't title, if you don't get any constructive criticism that you think is going to help you, just have fun with your dog. It's such a good bonding experience. And like I said, I think, you know, getting to see her improve was just that, you know, light switch on in her of, hey, I'm doing this with my mom, you know, so just have fun.
Thank goodness. I just think that we forget that so easily, and it, with all the things going on, it's just a fun portion of it, because when we're out training, it's fun. And the dogs just get confused when they feel all that anxiousness and nervousness going right down the lead to them. And it completely puts them off, no matter what venue you're testing in.
Yep.
So, yeah. But, well, Melinda, was there anything else you wanted to add to this conversation that I might have missed, or a good Cento message?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think when it comes to hunt tests, they're for everyone. They're for anyone. Doesn't matter your demographic or training style or gender or what have you. It's, once again, another way to get out with your dog and keep them engaging in their hardwired genetic behaviors while continuing a bond with them. So I think that's a big thing that I would love for people to understand. You know, if this is something you've been thinking about and you're waiting for your sign, here it is. Go do it. Have fun. It's amazing. And, you know, if positive reinforcement is something new to you or something that may have been something you're not interested or turned off by, you know, maybe in this podcast, you know, I haven't given the full illusion of what this method of training is, but I highly encourage people to go out and learn more about it. You know, there's wonderful people that are way more advanced than myself in the bird dog world that are thriving with these training methods. Joe Lawrence has the book Force Free Gun Dog. She is a wonderful resource. Dr. Dale Hubbard is an animal behavioralist in Georgia who does all of his dog training, bird dog training with positive reinforcement. And he's right on YouTube. So if I haven't given it to you in a digestible way, I still say find resources that are going to employ more of the knowledge on you. And yeah, stay a little open-minded about it.
Where can we find you and Shug in the future? Are you guys going to give the NAVDA natural ability test a try? You're planning on going for senior master? What is
we're
up?
We're going to do whatever we can. I love her. She's highly intelligent, you know, not biased or anything, you know, but she has her first NA test for NAVDA in May. We're going to Spoon River to do her natural ability test. She has been working nice and hard on, you know, her water work and her tracking. You know, we're once again now talking with people, getting advice from them. So we have a lot of work to do, but we're excited. And then the weekend after her NA test, she will be doing her next hunt test to try to finish up her junior hunter title.
Awesome. Cool. Well, tell us how we can find you on social media and follow what you're doing there. And if anybody lives in Indianapolis and can help utilize your training resources.
For sure. So first you can find us on Instagram. It's where we're most active. And it's at urban.uplander. We once again provide a multitude of different pet sitting services, and the dog training is just a bonus to everything we do. So if you are looking for pet care in the Indianapolis area, you can give us a call, shoot us an email. Our website is urbanuplanderllc@.com. So you can find us on, you know, pretty much anywhere you enter our name. And yeah, if you're in Indianapolis and you have a bird dog, please reach out, because we understand how hard it is to accumulate these resources, and we can save you a couple phone calls if you get a hold of us.
Awesome. You're amazing. Thank you, Melinda. I appreciate all your information and insight and sharing your vulnerable experiences at your first hunt test. So yeah. I'm so stoked that weekend went well for you, and you have that eagerness to go and do more.
For sure. We're so excited.
I'm excited to follow you and Shug's successes in the future. So awesome. Keep at it, girlfriend.
Thank you. We appreciate you having us.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bird Dog Babe podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, share it and tag me and someone that would benefit from listening. Please help me out by giving the podcast a rating and review on whichever platform you're listening from, and hit subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Be sure to join me on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. And if you're interested in some Bird Dog Babe swag or gear that I rely on, be sure to check out the store on thebirddogbabe.com. And most importantly, don't forget to support the organizations that are working hard to conserve the birds you're chasing after and the public lands in which you hunt.